From BDWPS.com and BDWPS Podcast, this is The Year of the Bowie, an 8-episode podcast series that tells the story of David Bowie. I'm your host, Andy, and if you haven't listened to episode number 1 yet, I would recommend going and giving that a listen before you proceed with today's episode. If you like what you hear on this month's episode, I would love if you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Just search Year of the Bowie. And now back to the story of David Bowie. When we last left off, I hinted towards David Jones' name change, but it should be clarified that the new persona wasn't completely David's idea. In 1966, he took on a new manager named Kenneth Pitt in hopes of kicking off his solo career after multiple failed attempts with various bands. Here's what Tony Visconti had to say about the new addition to David Jones' team.
Ken was a lot older than us, and he must have been at least 20 years older, and a showbiz kind of icon in the sense of theater.
Pitt informed David that there was a Davy Jones gaining fame and notoriety with a band called The Monkees. David jumped at the chance to start anew and came up with the new moniker, David Bowie, named after the Texas Revolutionary Colonel James Bowie. The newly named Bowie felt the name gave him an American edge, although he always struggled with knowing how to say the name.
I mean, do you think of yourself as Bowie or David Jones, the boy from South London?
Less and less as Bowie.
How are we supposed
to pronounce it? I don't even know how to pronounce it anymore. I've lost track. I always thought it was Bowie. I thought, well, it's a Scottish name, must be Bowie. But nobody in Scotland pronounces it like that. Pronounce it Bowie.
The first recordings as David Bowie, or Bowie, or Bowie, whatever you want to call him, would be with respected producer Tony Hatch. The two of them would work feverishly on several tracks. Bowie really wanted to put more emphasis on the production put into his songs. One of the first tracks to come out of these sessions was I Dig Everything.
I've got the village powder.
Dig everything.
I walk along beside the garbage man as I dig everything.
Dig everything.
I wave to the policeman, but they don't wave back.
Despite David's hopes for the song's success, his failures to crack the charts would continue to haunt him. As a result, Bowie's time spent with Pi Records would be short-lived. Hatch said of the experience, "I recognized something special about Bowie, and I was disappointed when we couldn't make others realize just how original he was. I agreed with the label that we should part company, but bloody hell, I knew it wouldn't be long before we'd see him at number one." Pitt would quickly pick up the pieces from the failed Pi venture by working out a deal with Darum Records. With most of his tracks already written, Bowie went into the studio with producer Mike Vernon and put together what would be his first full-length album. The songs resembled the cheeky, fun-loving spirit of his Pi efforts, but ironically, Bowie was discovering more mind-expanding influences at that same time. Earlier that year, Pitt returned from a trip to New York City with tapes from a band named The Velvet Underground. He had taken a meeting with pop artist Andy Warhol to discuss the band, but Pitt didn't have much interest in them and found their music to be, well, rubbish. He chose to pass the tapes along to Bowie, who was always interested in American music, and David would be blown away by the innovative sounds from across the pond.
It's just the wasted years so close behind.
A then manager brought back an album. It was just a plastic demo album of the Velvet's very first album in 1965-ish, something like that. And he was particularly pleased because Warhol had signed the sticker on the middle. I still have it, by the way. I still have that album. And he said, well, I don't know why he's doing music. This music's as bad as his painting. I thought, I'm going to like this. So I'd never heard anything quite like it. It was a revelation to me. There were elements of what Lou was doing that I thought were just unavoidably right for both the times and for where music was going. One of it was the use of the of cacophony as background noise, and to create a kind of an ambience that had been hitherto unknown in rock, I think.
During that same time, Bowie caught a little band called Pink Floyd performing at the Marquee in London. On that night, Bowie watched in awe as singer Syd Barrett put on a spectacle, playing his guitar with a Zippo lighter, singing the blues with a distinctive English drawl, and flinging his body about the stage like a madman. The lyrics were otherworldly, and his stage presence was something that stuck with Bowie. Despite the impact these two pioneering bands had on David, the music released on his first album didn't remotely resemble the artistic endeavors he admired, mostly because the material he recorded had been written prior to these discoveries. His first three singles from the album, Rubber Band, Love You Till Tuesday, and The Laughing Gnome, would underachieve like all of his prior efforts. However, the latter two singles would go on to be remembered fondly. Decades later, Love You Till Tuesday would inspire The Cure's Friday I'm in Love, the Amy Mann-fronted 80s band Till Tuesday, and the replacement song Love You Till Friday.
Just look through your window. Look who sits outside. Little me is waiting, standing through the night. When you walk out through your door, I'll wave my flag and shout, beautiful baby, my burning desire started on Sunday. Give me your heart and I'll love you till Tuesday.
The Laughing Gnome, which is an embarrassing track with its high-pitched chorus and silly demeanor, has become somewhat of a cult classic with Bowie fans. Fans have grown to love the song so much that when Bowie performed at a fan request show in 1999, the studio was flooded with calls for The Laughing Gnome. The song pales in comparison to the innovative works of Pink Floyd and the Velvet Underground at the time, but it's still a fun little song nonetheless. Here's the legendarily silly and surprisingly catchy Laughing Gnome.
I was walking down the high street when I heard footsteps behind me, and there was a little old man, the scarlet and gray, chuckling away. Well, he trotted back to my house, and he sat beside the telly with his tiny hands on his tummy, chuckling away, laughing all day. Oh, to report you to the gnome office.
Gnome office. Oh, yeah.
I'm a laughing gnome and you can't catch me. I'm a laughing gnome and you can't catch me, said the laughing gnome. Well, I gave him roasted toadstools and a glass of dandelion wine. Then I put him on a train to Eastbourne, carried his bag and gave him a fag.
Have you got a light, boy?
Yeah, where do you come from?
No man's land.
Oh, really? In the morning, when I woke up, he was sitting on the edge of my bed with his brother, whose name was Fred. He brought him along to sing me a song. All right, let's hear it. Yeah, what's that clicking noise? I'm a laughing gnome and you can't catch me. I'm a laughing gnome and you can't catch me.
Owner, I'm a gnome, am I?
Haven't you
you got a gnome to go to?
No, we had all that.
Didn't they teach you to get your hair cut at school? You look like a rolling gnome.
Yeah, not at the London School of Economics.
Now they're staying up the chimney, and we're living on caviar and honey. Cos they're earning me lots of money, writing comedy prose for radio shows. It's the gnome service, of course.
The fact that the Laughing Gnome was released the same day as the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band should give you a hint as to why the song didn't quite take off on the radio. Manager Pitt wasn't quite ready to give up on his prodigy just yet, and he decided to shift his protege's focus on acting. He just wanted to get David's face out there for people to see. Bowie's first role would be in an avant-garde short entitled The Image. In the film, Bowie played the part of a painting that comes to life. The film would be screened at gay porno theaters in the 1970s during Bowie's rise to fame, but in 1967, the movie went nowhere. He also tried out for a part in John Schlesinger's Sunday Bloody Sunday, but would lose the part to singer and actor Murray Head. Bowie's solo music career and acting career may have been off to a bumpy start, but that was the least of his concerns. At home, his brother Terry was quickly falling prey to mental illness. Days would pass where Terry would disappear and be found days later, lost and confused. On one occasion, he walked to a completely other town where he was found hiding in the Chislehurst Caves. Terry would later say that he had been drawn to the caves by a voice calling out his name. He claimed to have seen Christ and received counsel within the caverns. He would end up passed out in the cave for 8 days before venturing out, bleary-eyed and confused, where he was eventually found wandering around a grocery store. David's mother would promptly have Terry placed in the Cane Hill Asylum. Terry's struggles weighed heavy on young David's mind. In the past, he would turn to Terry for guidance during difficult times, but now, the difficult times were a direct result of Terry's mental illness. Bowie seriously considered giving up on his career and moving to a Buddhist monastery in Edinburgh, Scotland. He'd been studying Buddhism for the past year and saw Terry's struggle as a sign. Bowie may have made the move if it hadn't been for the arrival of producer Tony Visconti into his life during the same time. Brooklyn-born Visconti, who also happened to be interested in Buddhism, was brought to London to work with producer Denny Cordell. One afternoon, Cordell came to Visconti with Bowie's first album and asked him to check it out.
Well, I met David about a month after I met Mark, and it was through our mutual publisher, David Platts at Essex Music. They had a problem with David Bowie's image. You know, they didn't really know what he was and how they could market him. His very first album was kind of all over the place. And when I heard it, I told David Platts that it was. And he said, well, would you like to meet him? And I said, well, yeah, he's great. He sounded like a very intelligent, very talented young man. And I said, of course I'd like to meet a person like that. And it was a setup. David was actually in the next room, waiting to meet me.
In his new producer, Bowie found someone to fill the void left by his brother, Terry. Together, they began working on music that better reflected the artistic direction Bowie wished to explore. The first song to come out of these sessions was Karma Man, a song with Eastern spiritual influence, Bob Dylan-style lyricism, and eerie production that stood in stark contrast to Bowie's prior work.
Fingertips on the side show stalls, they throw the balls at coconut fur that hides behind colored shies that blind your eyes. Every child's mother holds an ice cream cone, they circle round, perceived unknown by an eye that peers from a hole in the tent where no one goes. They
figure sitting cross-legged on the floor. He's cloaked and clothed in saffron robes, his beads are all he owns.
Slow down,
someone must have said, let's slow him down.
Slow down,
it's pictured on the arms of the gun.
While the Bowie-Visconti collaboration gave much promise, Derham Records cut ties with the young artist after the letdown of his solo debut. Meanwhile, manager Ken Pitt continued working the acting angle, getting Bowie a cameo on a TV commercial for Lion's Mane Ice Cream. He even got a speaking part at the end of the advertisement. That audio doesn't do justice to this clip, so I'm going to be posting videos to bdwps.com for you to go check out. You can go to that right now if you want. I'm going to be posting all of the different strange acting ventures that I talk about in this episode. When you see the ad, it's pretty obvious that Bowie was chosen for his youth and his shaggy-haired hippie look. During this time, Pitt also got Bowie a role as a dancer in the BBC production of The Pistol Shot. This small role may seem like a blip on the Bowie landscape, but it was on the set of this show that he met his first true love, Hermione Farthingale. The two hit it off right away due to their shared interest in Buddhist philosophy, macrobiotic diet, and modern art. Soon after, the two young hippies would be dating and before long living together. Hermione also played acoustic guitar, a fact that led Bowie to the decision to start a folk band with her and guitarist John Hutchinson, and they named the band Feathers. The threesome put together a stage show that involved folk covers, spoken word poetry, and mime interludes. Many of Bowie's biggest supporters, including Visconti and Pitt, felt Hermione had led him astray. Here's a clip of her singing on the song Ching-a-ling.
Was flying through an azure cloud, a crystal girl I spied. She kissed the bluebird's honey tongue and stuttered as she sighed. I wish to sing the ching-a-ling song, the ching-a-ling song is fine. I'd give my jewels and caviar to make this daydream mine. Ching-a-ling, 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 ching-a-ling.
Meanwhile, Pitt continued pushing for a Bowie acting career. With little in the way of opportunities, Pitt decided the best option would be to create their own Bowie film to display his talents. The film, entitled Love You Till Tuesday, would be comprised of various vignettes, most of which were clips of Bowie performing some of his older, failed material. The idea was that if people saw him performing his songs, they might finally appreciate him as an artist, an idea that would flourish in the 1980s with the inception of MTV. Today, the Bowie film is seen as a low point in his career. From a mime performance to air guitar to dressing up like a child, the entire project is quite laughable in hindsight.
When I'm five, I will wash my face and hands all by myself. When I'm five, I will chew and spit tobacco like my Grandfather Jones. I'm only four and five is far away.
Hermione was also set to be in the film, although she bowed out during filming due to an opportunity to audition for the musical Song of Norway. This didn't sit well with Bowie. He felt betrayed. By the end of filming, both the band Feathers and his relationship with Hermione would be finished. The end of his short-lived relationship with Hermione would leave Bowie heartbroken, but it also resulted in an artistic renaissance. Isolated from friends and family, Bowie began writing about his heartbreak in songs like Letter to Hermione and An Occasional Dream. He also drew heavy influences during this time from pop culture, whether it be Simon and Garfunkel's Bookends or the latest movie at the Cinemaplex. One movie would have a lasting impact on his career. In 1968, the world was enamored by Stanley Kubrick's visual masterpiece, 2001: A Space Odyssey. But Bowie felt drawn to the film for different reasons. He could relate to the feelings of isolation that he shared with the astronauts in the film. A particular scene from the movie would inspire one of Bowie's most well-known songs to date. In the scene, an astronaut attempts to communicate with his family on Earth.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you, Squirt?
Hello.
What are you doing?
Playing.
Where's Mummy?
Going to shopping.
Oh, who's taking care of you?
Rachel.
May I speak to Rachel, please?
She's going to the bathroom. Are you coming to my party tomorrow?
I'm sorry, sweetheart, but I can't.
Why not?
You know, Daddy's traveling. Very sorry about it, but I just can't.
Feeling an affinity to the disconnected character, Bowie went home and penned a new song entitled Space Oddity that told the story of an astronaut named Major Tom lost in space. Pitt was blown away by the new song due to its melody, unique storytelling, and because the world was currently caught up in space fever due to the upcoming Apollo 11 mission. A demo was quickly recorded and shopped around to labels. Mercury liked the song and signed Bowie to a modest deal. When it came time to record a proper studio version of Space Oddity, Bowie asked Visconti to help out, but his friend passed due to his view that the song was a novelty, written to make cash off the excitement surrounding the NASA launch. Bowie would record the new version with producer Gus Dungeon at London's Trident Studios. With lush albums like Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and Pet Sounds gaining critical attention, Bowie and Dungeon worked tirelessly toward making a complex arrangement complete with strings, a stylophone, and a mellotron. Dungeon's production exudes through the track, from the acoustic guitars, swathed in a watery effect, and vocals that resonated with a cacophonous reverb. The track would also be recorded in stereo, a first for the young Bowie. The results would be Bowie's first hit song and the beginning of the music career he had worked so hard to achieve. More on Bowie's arrival into the mainstream next time on The Year of the Bowie.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. 10, ground control to Major Tom.
7, 6,
commencing countdown, engines on.
3, 2,
check ignition,
1.
And may God's love be with you.
This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade, and the papers want to know whose shirt you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare. This is Major Tom to ground control. Stepping through the door, and I'm floating in a most peculiar way, and the stars look very different today. For here am I sitting in a tin can.